Good afternoon again, everyone. We will proceed to our next case that's set for argument. This is David Frostick versus the State of Nevada. Mr. Frostick is represented here today by Mr. Erickson.
Yes.
All right, thank you. And the State is represented by Mr. Nyman.
Yes, sir.
All right. Mr. Erickson, would you like any time in rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I requested 5 minutes.
Okay, all right. Well, let's set it for 5 minutes, and we'll see how it goes. You are free to proceed now.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. On behalf of my client, we appreciate the opportunity to stand before you and go through some of the issues that we think are most important at this point, but certainly understand that if what I'm focusing on is not what the Court had questions about, please just direct me and I'll address those. But I wanted to focus on two areas. The one is the hearsay argument relative to the victim's father's testimony, and then the second area that I want to focus on was the Court's refusal to allow the jury instruction on voluntary intoxication. As to the hearsay statement of the father who testified, there were two challenges to that testimony. If you may recall from the briefing, there was a phone call that the father testified to that he talked to his daughter shortly before she was unfortunately killed. In that conversation, what he testified to was that he asked her, "Is he there?" Did not use a name, did not make a reference to who the he is, and in the there's certainly nothing from the record indicating that it was ever identified that it was Mr. Frostig that the daughter, in her response, was responding to. So that is one of the central attacks on the reliability of that testimony as an exception to the hearsay rule. Was his question simply was, is he there? No name used. And I think that causes significant issues as to the reliability of what any response to that question would have elicited. The second challenge goes to what the Court concluded was a present sense impression. There was simply no evidence whatsoever as to when the victim had last seen or had contact with what was arguably my client, Mr. Frostick. There simply was no evidence presented that she had recently seen him or any timing whatsoever. And that is critical under the case law as to it either being a present sense impression or an immediate recounting of sense. And the case law is quite clear on that. And from what was presented in the state's argument as to why that exception should apply, there was simply no evidence as to the timing of when.
So let me see if I understand your argument. Your argument is before you can allow a present sense impression about an event to be admitted to the trial, you have to have independent evidence that the event that's being perceived actually happened before you allow the present sense impression? Is that what you're arguing? I just want to make sure I understand your argument.
No, not that it actually happened, but the timing of it. Because the exception is based on that it was present, and there was simply no evidence as to when it was that the victim had seen or knew the location of Mr. Frostick. And that was not elicited from the father's testimony or any other evidence that was presented. So it's not an argument that you have to prove that it happened. It's an argument that there has to be some evidence as to the timing of it to trigger the exception under the hearsay rule that it was a present sense impression. And that's simply lacking in the record. There's no indication as to when she made had the impression that he was present. The next area that I want to focus on is to the jury instruction.
Before you turn to that, you said earlier that reliability was not established because the question was, is he there versus is David there or someone else? how does that go to the reliability? Isn't that more of a question for the jury if the jury wants to rely upon it as opposed to its initial admissibility?
Well, Your Honor, where it's our position that where the state is introducing this statement and it's based on an exception to the hearsay rule, that one of the things that the court has to look at is whether there is a sufficient basis of reliability of this hearsay statement being introduced. And in this particular case, there is no evidence as to who the daughter thought the father was referring to. I mean, obviously people can suppose that she was referring to the boyfriend, but there is simply no indication independent of what was presented to the trial judge.
Maybe if you look at it, in isolation, it's a vague question because the question is he there? But she answers it, right? She answers it in a way that's actually responsive to the question, yes, he's there. So she understood it to mean something. He understood it to mean something. I understand you're saying that essentially that looking at it now objectively, there's no name in it, but the fact that she responded suggests that she understood the question, whether or not, it's apparent when you write it on a piece of paper.
Well, and Your Honor, I would submit that is the problem, is that we don't have testimony from the victim, obviously, as to who it was she was assuming the father was referring to. But one of the facts that was presented in the statement of facts is that there, from the expert presented by the defense at trial, was that the victim had DNA consistent with another individual under her fingernails. So one of the defenses that was presented was that someone else had been the person who had killed the young lady. And so the assumptions that she was interpreting her father's question to be the same person, we submit is simply insufficient under this type of exception to the right to confront one's witnesses. Here, obviously, the victim we were not able to cross-examine her, and we simply do not know her state of mind as to who she assumed the father was speaking about when he did not use the name.
All right. Why don't you go ahead with the jury instruction argument?
And on this issue, the case law is replete with the basis that, and this is, I'm quoting here from the Boykins versus State case from 2000, that a defendant in a criminal case is entitled, upon request, to a jury instruction on his or her theory of the case, so long as there is some evidence, no matter how weak or incredible, to support it. One of the, I would submit, critical mistakes in the trial was the judge's exclusion of the jury instruction relative to voluntary intoxication.
So the issue, if I could just, as I understand the issue here, basically the issue, you're saying that evidence that the defendant may have been drinking, we're not sure exactly when, because there's a gap in time, but evidence that he's drinking on the day of the crime is weak, or is at least weak or incredible evidence that he may have been intoxicated at the time, right? You're saying that they're kind of the same thing. Evidence of drinking is weak evidence of intoxication. And I think the state's argument would be they're actually two different things. Drinking and intoxication are not just on the same scale. They're actually two different things. So am I framing the issue correctly?
As I understand it, yes. And I'll go into some detail on how I think the evidence is there to support that instruction. The main case that we cited was the Nevius versus State case from 1985. When I went in, that indicates that a defendant can have an involuntary instruction of intoxication presented, and then it cites the first case that it cites, and I'm going to get into this one in quite a bit of detail, is the State versus Bordelais. It's a French word, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it's an old case from 1954. And that case goes into a fair amount of important detail, I think, and I just want to quote some of the questioning that case went through to determine whether or not the instruction was appropriate. And just briefly, they had two officers testify at that trial. And one of the officers, the questioning went along these lines. Now, as you move along down the highway, is it true that you lost concern over Vernon becoming intoxicated and Vernon was the suspect? The answer was yes. Question, was his speech coherent? Answer, yes, sir. Question, did he speak plainly? Answer, yes. Question, were his eyes clear? Answer, I am not sure of the conditions of his eyes. Then the deputy sheriff testified, now, Officer Bell, while you were walking with the defendant, did you have an opportunity to observe whether he was steady on his feet? Answer, yes, sir. Question, how did he walk? Answer, he walked straight up the road without help. Question, was he standing erect? Answer, yes. Question, did you have the opportunity to observe whether there was a smell of odor or odor of alcohol on his breath? Answer, there was not. And asked about bloodshot eyes, things of that nature. So it goes through in quite a bit of detail of these officers as to their observation of the defendant, and the conclusion in the opinion is, in reading the entire record in this case, we find that while there is some evidence of drinking on the part of the defendant, there is not a particle of evidence contained therein to show that the defendant was intoxicated at the time of the commission of the crime. Here, in contrast, the evidence that was presented, and this is in the appellate record at pages 3146 through 48 is where this testimony was presented. And it includes the following. One, Officer Laura was able to smell alcohol in Mr. Frostig from 3 feet away. Two, Officer Coyne was able to smell alcohol on Frostig. Three, Detective Kistner, while seated in his car, could smell alcohol on Frostig. Four, Officer Coyne described Frostick as having a blank look on his face and that he was non-responsive. Five, Frostick slipped and fell while walking out of the house. Six, there was an empty bottle of champagne in the house and two other bottles of wine that were missing at least some of the alcohol. And seven, one of the wine glasses had Frostick's DNA on it. And eight, the victim had blood alcohol level of at least 0.12. That evidence that was presented at the trial, I would submit, parallels pretty closely to what the court back in 1954 looked at to see if there was actual evidence of intoxication, not just that there had been drinking, but that there was intoxication.
Well, let me ask you this. So there's a 30-minute time gap, and I don't know why. I'm assuming the police didn't know it was an actual homicide, so they kind of took their time in responding. So the police don't arrive until 30 minutes after the murder. So what you're saying, what you're describing, is evidence of what they observed 30 minutes afterwards. So the argument you're making is, inferentially, if he's showing signs of intoxication 30 minutes after the crime, ipso facto, that's evidence that he may have been intoxicated 30 minutes earlier during the crime? Or do you have to have some affirmative evidence that during the crime, and I know the defendant didn't testify in this case, but if he had, hypothetically, he could have said, yes, during the crime, I was intoxicated. Now you have at least some affirmative evidence that during the crime and not 30 minutes afterwards, he was actually intoxicated.
So I would submit that what has to be presented to the jury and what they can consider is whether the evidence suggests that the defendant was intoxicated to the point that it could affect his ability to have the requisite intent necessary for the first degree murder charges that he was ultimately convicted of. A couple of important things in conjunction or with the case, the Bordeaux case from 1954. That case involved a robbery allegations, and they said that the suspect, right before he shot the guy, had taken money from him and things. And so one of the things they argued was, well, even if he was intoxicated, that the felony murder rule could have kicked in the first degree conviction anyway. Here we've got boyfriend-girlfriend allegations of murder at their residence. The intoxication certainly under the case law, it is not a pure defense to the crime, but it is allowed as a consideration for the mental deliberations that are required for some of the first degree requirements. And that is the focus here, that should have been presented to the jury for them to determine whether the state had proved beyond reasonable doubt that he had the requisite intent for the first degree murder.
Mr. Erickson, wasn't it in fact presented to the jury? The jury heard the facts, the arguments were made. The only thing that's missing is an instruction that tells the jury that you can consider intoxication in determining a person's intent.
It was presented, Your Honor, yes. But I would submit to Your Honor that those jury instructions are critical for giving the jury the direction on how to sort through and piece together all this information that comes to them during a trial. And the failure to give them that direction, that they can take that information, and if they found that that was a basis to find a second degree murder conviction, that was necessary in order for him to have a fair trial. The Boykins case and that line of cases says a defendant is entitled to present his defense and is entitled to jury instructions that enable him to present it in an effective way to a jury. And you know, in hindsight, it is very easy to say that a jury could have done this or that, but when you sit through trial after trial and you watch them go through and mark up jury instructions trying to figure out how they put together the facts that they've received to those instructions, I would argue that it is critical that the instructions are correct and that was a fundamental flaw in this trial with the judge not presenting that jury instruction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Erickson.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll hear from the state.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is John Nyman. I represent the state of Nevada. I'll cover the same two points that were covered in the argument, although, of course, if the court has questions about anything else that was briefed, I'd be happy to address those. Regarding the hearsay argument, Judge Tao, Judge Gibbons, both of you, I think, identified exactly the issue, which isn't what Robin meant by yes, a question for the jury, and kind of unsurprisingly, then Judge Kadish also determined exactly the same thing. In fact, at the appellant's appendix, it was volume 3, page 507, the state argued the interpretation of Robin's answer is subject to argument by defense and the state, and the court said, right, they can argue the inference. Everybody could argue what it was that Robin meant when she said yes. And in fact, in pretrial motions, there was a pretrial motion to exclude that counsel had filed. I don't think it was ultimately trial counsel. It was one of Mr. Frostick's previous attorneys, where they were trying to exclude this statement. The state affirmatively said in the opposition, I'm looking here at the record on pages 449 through 460, that the state won't elicit who it is that the dad, that Victor Jenkins, thought Robin Jenkins meant when she said yes, because that would just be pure speculation. We can't ask one witness to speculate as to what the decedent in this case meant when she said yes. And really, you know, the word yes, it's difficult even for me to think of how that's the truth of the matter asserted, because the assertion is really an implication, right? The who it is that she meant is implied by her answer, which I think is why they wanted to exclude it, because of that implication. But it's not evident from the word yes itself. To address the first point, you know, there was no foundation as to when she had observed whoever it was she meant by the word yes. The court had found that it was a present sense impression, and I think that the question itself demands a present sense. Is he there right now? Right. Not was he there, not will he be there.
Well, so I think this is the argument that he's making. Normally, a present sense impression, sometimes you have the information in the statement itself that suggests that that indicates what you're seeing. Oh my God, I just saw this guy, you know, hit that guy with a bat. if that statement comes in, it's pretty clear that I'm, you know, there's a lot of information there. What I'm seeing and also that I'm seeing it right now. So I think his argument is this. If you ask, is he there right now, and you say yes, I think his argument is that does not necessarily mean she's observing him right now. It could actually mean that, well, she saw him 10 minutes ago and she didn't hear him leave the house, and maybe he's still in the house, but she's not actually got her, she doesn't actually have her eyes on him right now. I think that's his argument.
And certainly that's a fair enough point. And I think that part of the difficulty here was the way that Victor Jenkins' testimony had to be bifurcated. He testified both in the guilt phase and later on in the penalty phase. And one of the things that he testified about in the penalty phase was the reason why questions were answered in the way that they were, that he would phrase certain questions. And that was because previously, Mr. Frostick had attacked or committed domestic violence or threatened it against Robin Jenkins because he was upset when she would talk to her family. Basically, if he thought that she was talking to her family, he might become violent. Now, that couldn't come out during the guilt phase of the trial because it would have introduced other bad acts that Mr. Frostick had presented or whatnot. But I think it's important for context, sort of retrospectively, as to why she might not have given a more complete answer. And I think that the context of the phone call itself, right, in very short order, the question was, is he there? Yes. Shortly thereafter, no, no, drop it. Then she starts screaming, and then her family calls the police, which is one of the reasons why it took, I think, the police so long to get there, because a phone call was coming from California requesting a welfare check to an address in Las Vegas that, I don't know that certainly until Officer Coyne walked up on the house and saw an enormous blood streak outside, that they knew how serious or what the issue was that was going on there.
So are you saying during the phone call itself that everything happened very quickly? You have the question, and then the father on the other end is hearing what's happening in that room?
Correct. The father on the phone hears Robin scream, says that he, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember exactly what his testimony was, but that he felt this sense of dread. He calls out to his son, who lives with him, I believe it was in California, and says, you know, something terrible's happened to Robin, call the police.
But the father knows there's somebody else in the room from what he can hear over the phone?
Well, there would have to be somebody else in the room for what happened on that phone call to make any sense.
So I'm trying to get to the contemporaneous issue, whether we know we're talking about the same point in time.
Correct. And so I think that it's certainly, although she didn't describe it in so many words, a fair inference that, to put it bluntly, if she is about to get stabbed, she can answer that question, although I don't think it was necessarily quite so immediate that she thought that her life was in danger, because presumably she might have said something other than yes in that instance. But at most, we're talking about a matter of a few minutes, and it certainly indicates that she knew that somebody there was at the house, which again, I think, goes to then-Judge Kadish's ruling that both parties can argue the inference as to who she met. And when we're reviewing this for an abuse of discretion, I don't think that the judge abused her discretion in allowing both parties to argue the possible implications of that statement.
Right. That assumes you get past the foundation question, though.
Correct.
Right.
Moving on then to the voluntary intoxication instruction. I suppose that I'll first, again, agree with something that the court had said in the previous argument, that under Nebius, there needs to be some evidence that the intoxication affected the defendant's state of mind. And Judge Tao, I believe, as you pointed out, one, that inference, that argument, all of that was made during closing. All of that information was in front of the jury. It really is just a question about a jury instruction.
But Mr. Nyman, this was an open murder charge in this particular case. So the jury is left to decide among the many levels of murder which one is appropriate. In that situation, isn't an instruction on the defendant's theory of the case even more important to give?
So I have, I think, two answers to that. One, yes, of course it's important that an instruction on the defendant's theory of the case is given, but an instruction is only warranted if there's some evidence to support it. And there was no evidence that Mr. Frostick was intoxicated at the time that he committed the murder, or at the time that certainly the state argued that he committed the murder at the time. Was there potentially some evidence that he had been drinking at some point? Maybe, right? The officers did smell alcohol. He did fall down, although Judge Kadish said, well, that probably had more to do with the fact that he was handcuffed and slipped in the blood that was outside rather than the fact that he was intoxicated. All of the officers testified that he answered their questions coherently. There wasn't any sort of issues that they could see in terms of him being intoxicated, which is he may have drank, but he may not have been intoxicated. I note that counsel cited the Bordeaux case, but that wasn't in the opening brief. However, I don't think it necessarily changes anything because just from listening to the representation, my sense was that that was maybe a driving under the influence sort of case and not a murder case. However, the other thing that I want to point out is something that was said in the reply brief, the reply brief at 4 said that the defendant's theory of the case was that some other assailant killed Robin. Now, I looked at the opening arguments of counsel. I looked at the closing arguments of defense counsel. I disagree with that reading. I don't think that that's what they were arguing, but certainly I'm not in the position to know what it was the defense theory of the case was other than what showed up at the transcript. But if that really is the defendant's theory of the case, that somebody else killed Robin, it doesn't matter how intoxicated he was. It doesn't matter how much he had been drinking or whether he was drunk or intoxicated when somebody else presumably murdered Robin. And so I'm not quite clear how that would apply.
Right. Can't the defense argue inconsistent theories?
The defense can, but I don't think the defense did. And the way that I read the defense's argument certainly had more to do with the state of mind. I think that they were arguing about intent and that they were arguing about, frankly, more, I would say, heat of passion. I'll quote some of the things that the defense said in closing, which gives me that thought. 14 Appellant's Appendix 3206, what evidence has the state presented that shows that there was any deliberation in what transpired in this case? At 3207, they've not proved and presented anything to show that this was a premeditated and deliberate murder. At 3209, a couple of things did come out that you can take into consideration in deciding whether or not this speaks more of a rash impulse than a premeditated, deliberate situation. I think that what they were arguing was that he got so angry that he didn't actually premeditate and deliberate.
Hey, Mr. Diamond, do you know how many times Robin was stabbed?
10, I believe.
And does it revealed in the record which stab was the fatal wound?
It does. And so comes up.
And do you know in the sequence of events if it was 1, 2, 3, or 10?
So as far as I could tell from the record, nobody was able to tell in which order the stabs occurred. However, when the appellant was arguing about the prejudicial photos, this goes to photograph 93, which was not provided in the record, but my understanding is that it showed a severed artery somewhere in the shoulder area. We had argued that this shows not only the fatal blow, but it shows why there was arterial splatter and why there was essentially blood on the ceiling. That was a photograph that, in a collection of others, described what was called wound number 7. Again, I don't know what order that was presented in. Let's see. I'm not sure. I think I lost part of the question.
So what I was getting to is if there was evidence of intent, for example, if you stab somebody one time, provocation, heat of the moment, mm-hmm. lack of formulation, of premeditation, all of that is very much in play. If you stab somebody 10 times, much less in play.
Correct. And when we had argued particularly the prejudicial photographs below, let me just find the correct citation here. We had indicated, and in fact the district court held, that the photograph was relevant both as to injury and to blood splatter, the injury being not only what killed her, but sort of the deliberation and the intent, as you say. So yes, that does go to the fact that this was not an accident. This isn't something that just occurred. And I think that the actions after the fact, for that matter, point to the fact of deliberation. The evidence that was adduced at trial was that not only was she stabbed multiple times, she made her way outside. He then dragged her back inside to the carpet and closed the door. When the officers show up half an hour later, there's a giant blood stain out there. Officer Coyne enters the house. Mr. Frostick had at some point perhaps superficially cut his wrist. There was DNA, both his and Robin's, on a patio chair outside. He was holding a knife, barefoot
so
in blood.
There's a lot of evidence here, but the question is, as Mr. Erickson pointed out, it doesn't really matter how thin the defense case is. You still get an instruction on your theory of the case if there's any evidence to support it. And you've indicated earlier on that there was a 30-minute time gap. And is that gap enough to break the chain of causation about whether the instruction should be given? In other words, let's say there's some evidence of intoxication 30 minutes after the crime. Mm-hmm. Is that essentially irrelevant because there's no evidence of intoxication at the moment of the crime?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's irrelevant, but I think that there does need to be some sort of evidence that shows that even if you were intoxicated, it had an effect on your mental state. And there simply wasn't any of that kind of evidence. At most, there was evidence that he had perhaps been drinking. And again, we go back to...
What was Judge Kadish's thinking on not giving the instruction? Because it seems like in most cases the defense instruction is given.
Correct. And I think that Judge Kadish went through the nebulous factors and had said exactly the same thing, that there's no evidence that's been presented that even if he was intoxicated, it affected his mental state at all. And because there was not any of that evidence presented, then Judge Kadish decided to decline to give the instruction.
So that even if he was intoxicated, the defense didn't take the next step and say, and that affected the mental state.
Correct, and not just say it, but present some evidence to show that. Yes.
Mr. Nyman, do you think, though, that the failure to give the jury instruction in this case deprived the jury of understanding the appellant's defense to at least the first-degree murder charge?
I don't think so, because I think that they were still allowed during closing to argue what effect that might have, to argue that it wasn't supposed to be first-degree murder, and not just because of the intoxication, but because of other general heat of passion arguments that I think that they actually made. And, again, as Judge Gibbons pointed out, the number of stabbings, the violence of the scene, the overwhelming evidence that was presented that he intended to kill Robin Jenkins, I think would make even this error harmless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Erickson, you used up your 5 minutes already on rebuttal. Do you have something that we really need to hear?
Your Honor, if I could have 60 seconds.
All right, go ahead.
I'm just going to highlight a couple of things that were said. The argument that Judge Kadish made this analysis that, well, maybe he when he fell, it was because he slipped in the blood and it wasn't an evidence of intoxication, I think is simply not the determination that the judge should be making when it comes to this instruction. I went through the list of one of the officers testified that he had a blank stare and was unresponsive in describing the demeanor of Mr. Frostegg, and I went through all of the officers who said that they smelled alcohol on him, the clear evidence that alcohol had been consumed in the house that day, the intoxication level of the victim of a 0.12. All of that suggests that there was sufficient evidence to present to the jury of this defense, and I would submit that these jurors have a very difficult time, period, trying to put all this together, and without the clear law explaining to them how they can analyze the evidence of intoxication as it applied to either first or second degree murder or voluntary
murder. Mr. Nyman's point is twofold, the 30-minute time gap and the fact there was no other evidence to explain how this would have affected the mental processes as they related to the various elements of the crime.
Your Honor, I would submit that in conjunction with the other evidence that was presented in the closing argument as to the lack of evidence of deliberation, things of that nature, that this was critical evidence. And the 30-minute time gap before the officers showed up, that certainly wasn't something that the state presented, showed, you know, he consumed the alcohol afterwards and that his intoxication evidence was something that came after the killing. So I don't think that those facts in any way negate the requirement that the judge instruct the jury properly and that be presented to them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you,